Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is engineer John Yash. And thanks, everybody. This is episode number 59. Boy, we got here fast, didn't we? So it's been more than a year. Hard to believe. But anyway, thank you for listening. First thing I want to talk about today is a new Instagram feature called Slash Music. A lot of you out there use Instagram and a lot of you don't. If you're using it for a promotional tool, it's really great, providing that your audience is there. If you don't have your audience there, then again, using it for fun is all right. But again, as a promotional tool, it's really great, providing that your fans are there. So assuming that they are, this new feature is actually right up your alley if you're an artist or a band. Again, it's called hashtag music. And what it is a new music category. Instagram is doing this because they discovered that about 25% of the activity on the service has to do with music. So it makes sense to try to take advantage of that. Even though Twitter did last year, Twitter had a service that they called At Music that failed badly. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One is that it was actually a separate app from Twitter, and it really didn't offer enough for people to want to open up a separate app. So it was kind of destined to fail as soon as it started. Not so for hashtag music. It's kind of interesting. Again, it's a music category, and it's focused more on up-and-coming artists than established artists. Now, what they've done is they've added a number of subcategories. One is called hashtag locally sourced, and this covers unsigned bands and artists. It's also curated by a number of people at Instagram. So they're always looking for new up-and-comers, and that's pretty cool. Sometimes it's an easier way to actually break out than to try to do it yourself and raise above the crowd. If you have a curator and if you can get the attention, usually that will speed things up somewhat, providing you get attention. Another subcategory is called hashtag 15-second lessons. And this is all about very, very short music performance lessons. How to play a riff on a song, how to sing in a certain style, things like that. Should be a lot of fun. And yet another one is called hashtag double track. And this is all about musicians' interests outside of music. So again, that's kind of cool as well. The best part about this is it's going to be updated 6 times a week. So look for that because this is actually something that with any kind of luck could benefit musicians that aren't stars and superstars, which is something that we all like. It's called hashtag music on Instagram. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program. It's 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks for the Small Studio. And you can go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. Now, here's a subject that we've talked about a lot in the past, and we've even had Eric Garland on the show, who is a financial analyst as well as a bass player, and he's talked extensively about Guitar Center and about the financial trouble that they're in. Well, Eric has been predicting for some time that it's only a matter of time before GC begins to liquidate, goes into bankruptcy, and becomes either a smaller entity or disappears completely. And it looks like there's actually some evidence of that beginning to happen, although it's very internal. It's not something that you'll see as a customer. What just happened was GC slashed the salesman's and manager's hours and commissions. Now, previous to this, salesmen were making 10% on profit and 2% on gross commission, and now what happened is they've slashed it down to 0.25%. That's it. And then, to add insult to injury, what they did is they raised the cost of buying gear from 10 to 15%. And of course, that's one of the big reasons why a lot of people want to work at Guitar Center. So if you take that all into consideration, that you're working less, you're making less money, and you really can't buy any gear at a great price, you have to think, well, what's the point of working there? One of the big problems that happens here is the fact that if you get unhappy employees, inevitably you're going to have unhappy customers. So we're going to see more and more of this, and it wasn't that great to begin with, although there are some pretty good people there that wanted to do well. But by and large, you have a pretty transient sales staff. The managers had stayed longer, and of course, they were paid better, but this is affecting even those guys. So what's happening is they're in a liquidation mode. Guitar Center, the company, is in a liquidation mode. So GC made it even worse. They made everybody sign new employment agreements. What they did is they reneged on all the promises in the employment agreements. So in other words, they promised new positions, which didn't happen, and a lot of benefits, all of which didn't happen. So now you have these people that are really in a bad position because they're working for a company that they probably didn't like to begin with, and they probably way dislike it now. So what we're seeing is the beginning of liquidation mode for Guitar Center. Don't be surprised if by the end of the summer, we see some really blockbuster things happening over there, and not in a good way. So I would say start to look around for other retailers to buy from, because you may not have GC as an alternative, or at least you won't have them as an inexpensive alternative for too much longer. My guest today is John Yosh, and everybody just knows him as Yosh. He's had a great career that's been just about as diverse as anybody in the business, from starting as a Detroit rocker to recording some of the great funk records with the likes of George Clinton, Parliament Funkadelic, and Bootsy Collins, and then to go to recording country stars like Billy Ray Cyrus and John Michael Montgomery, and then going to what he is today, a much, much in-demand mixer for Christian and gospel music stars like Kirk Franklin and Andre Crouch. Yosh has seen more sides of the music business than, I'd say, the majority of engineers that are working today. I spoke with Yosh from his French Beach studio in Franklin, Tennessee. So tell me about growing up in Detroit during the heyday of Motown. How much did that influence you?
It was a great influence. During that time, radio was a mixture of, you know, in Detroit, it was a mixture of Motown and rock, like Bob Seger and Mitch Ryder. And also, of course, the British Invasion happened. But, you know, I didn't realize until later how much that R&B pop thing influenced me until I started, till I was in the studio. And, but it was just a wonderful time to be in Detroit. And naturally, as a young kid, I decided I had to be a rock star. So I picked up a guitar and started a rock band and did that for like 10 years. Well, and of course that didn't work out.
Well, for the better, I think, actually.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a Detroit question. I don't know if you ever noticed, but out here, and I'm in Los Angeles, everybody mm-hmm. from Detroit dresses the same way. They have dyed black hair and a black leather jacket on and totally in black. I mean, you can always tell someone from Detroit because that's the way they dress. Is that common back there?
Yeah, I think so. I think it is common. Yeah. I think that comes out of, I don't know, maybe the MC5 or something. Yeah. Fred Sonic Smith and all those people.
Yeah.
Patty Smith. Yeah. I mean, I wear black a lot. I don't have black hair, obviously. I think we wear a lot of black. I don't know. Maybe it's an industrial thing.
So you were a rocker then, and you weren't much into the R&B side. But again, Detroit is a great rock town, so that's no surprise there.
It was. Right. But then what happened was, after when I was in this band, I went and recorded at a studio, and I enjoyed being on the other side of the glass more than actually recording. And I was watching the engineers and the producers. And I thought, I can do this, I think. So I thought, if this rock thing doesn't work for me, I want to do that. So about 4 or 5 years later, I find myself at the same studio in a recording class and realize I'm at this, four or five years when you're 18 to 20, 24 years old is a long time.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of pot around. No, I'm sorry. I was in the studio and went, wow, this is the place we did it. But it had changed the whole place. New owners had come in and changed the whole place. And it turns out the guys that were there teaching me were Motown guys. Wow. Motown and Holland Dozier Holland guys.
Yeah.
In fact, it was Bob Dennis and Greg Riley. Bob Dennis was the mastering engineer for Motown, mastered 30 number one singles.
Wow.
So those were my teachers. And so they taught me about R&B and Motown. And we taught me how to record that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the way they recorded at Motown.
Well, okay, here's a good question for you then. So was that any different than recording rock? Or
yes, it was.
How so?
It was, well, the biggest difference, I think, was the approach to drums and the way they started out songs. As far as approaching drums, it was all about, like, deadening the drums, you know, heavily, and making toms from the bottom, and
wow,
using a lot of condenser microphones, even on snares and things like that, to get some of those sounds that they had in the 60s and 70s. and I did, and, you know, starting out in that studio, I learned one way to record. And after about 2 years, an engineer came in named Ron Christopher, and his cousin was Dave Palmer, and Dave Palmer had started out with Eddie Kramer. And so when Ron came in, he said, "Oh man, take all that tape off the drums. Let's put the drums out in the room." You know, these are all things that everyone does now, you know, but at the time people in Detroit didn't do that. You know, he said, "Put the drums out in the room. The room's big. Let's get some room sounds in here," because we had a drum booth. And he said, "Get all the tape off the heads. We're gonna mic all these toms with 421s. You know, these are all normal things that we all do now. But like I said, we didn't know any better because we were being taught by the Motown guys, which was great because we had one sound. There was the R&B funk sound, and now we were learning the rock sound. So I kind of learned I learned the way Eddie Kramer was recording via Dave Palmer and Ron Christopher.
Wow. But that's so cool because you learn two of the best techniques, even though they're opposed, but you know, the success with both of them. Wow. That's great.
Yeah, it was. It was really fascinating. And the other thing about R&B, the way guys would, first of all, they'd write the songs in the studio. You know, George Clinton, Parliament Funkadelic, and Bootsy Collins, Sly Stone, they'd write the songs in the studio, and not as much, obviously, with rock bands. And Mitch Ryder came in, he had like 12 songs, and boom, we cut those songs like in 3 or 4 days.
Wow.
He did the vocals like in 3 or 4 days. You know, he never left. It was really strange. He stayed in the vocal room literally for 8 hours a day in this vocal space, drinking beer, and never left the room to go to the bathroom. So you can imagine what he was doing.
Wow. Wow.
But
I don't know if that's discipline. I don't know if that's great discipline or if it's stupidity or, you know, one or the other.
Just complete craziness, I think. That's all it was. The R&B guys, would write in the studio, and they would just start out with, you know, it could be, we had this thing we called the man in the box. It was a Roland, not a drum machine. It was just a Roland beat maker, like the same kind of thing that was in an organ, you know,
that
had samba and marimba.
Yeah.
Because they didn't really have any drum machines. Well, Lynn came out with a drum machine, obviously, you know, but we didn't have one in 1978. And so they would just start out with that meter, you know, something to keep meter to. And they would, somebody like Bootsy would either start out playing an Ovation guitar directly into the console just to get the idea for the song and map out the song, or he'd map it out with him and a keyboard player playing an old beat up Steinway piano that we had there. And they would just work out the arrangement with basically a click track and a guitar and a piano. Then as soon as they finished that, they Boosie would go out and cut drums to it. And you lay a drum track. And really, the last thing you ever laid on a track was the bass.
Huh. Very much like the Beatles.
Like the way exactly, like McCartney doing Sgt. Pepper, yeah. Laying the bass on last. You know,
yeah.
That's how he did it. Wow. He always kept in mind where the space was going to be for the bass.
Well, how did you get being a rock and roller, how did you get to suddenly work with P-Funk and George Clinton and Bootsy and all those guys? How did that happen?
It was just an accident because the studio was you know, Motown, Holland Dozier, Holland based, and George they did the big hits in the early or middle 70s at a place called United Sound in Detroit. And they started doing so much work. They were basically booking three studios 24 hours a day when United Sound couldn't handle how many acts he was working on, because there was George Clinton. He was a solo act. There was Parliament. There was Funkadelic. There were the Brides of Funkenstein, Parlette, Felipe Wynn. There were wow. So many acts that they had all associated. And then there was Roger Troutman and Zapp.
Yeah.
And then Bootsy had his own records too. So there were all these different artists. So it was just a crossover thing into our studio. And we started working 24 hours a day, and I learned how to record funk because of it. I probably recorded, and this goes with the learning curve of getting your 10,000 hours. And I think in 1 year, Bootsy and I probably cut 100 songs. Wow. So we recorded drums every day, you know.
Wow.
You know,
yeah.
In some sort of fashion. Not all the songs were used, but, you know.
Okay, so how was the approach to funk different than the Motown or the rock approaches that you had learned previously?
Probably the kick drum and the backbeat were paramount in any song. Uh-huh. And the bass, you know?
Yeah.
And also there's a lot of focus spent recording background vocals back then, you know, gang vocals, a lot of people in the studio doing backgrounds, a lot of unison vocals and just having fun with it. But it was definitely about getting the right bottom and the right backbeat on a song, whether it was a great snare sound or a great clap sound, you know, that was just completely different than everyone else's at the time.
Was there a secret?
So, secret to
the
kicks or the drums or
yeah
or
yeah what? Yeah yeah. Like, okay, if the kick drum is paramount, as it is in many cases today, what did you do special to make it that way?
I think one of the things was we started using 421s on the kick, and we had this one parametric equalizer. We didn't have any parametric equalizers except for one. It was an Orban parametric equalizer, and we learned how to suck out the low mids and pump up the bottom end and the top end that you couldn't really get out of some of the other EQs that we had. Like, well, we had an API console.
Oh.
So we had 32 great EQs on the console, API 550s.
Yeah.
But they didn't do what we wanted to with kick drums. And so we kind of came up with a certain standard that worked for our kicks to an Orban, but there was no compression. That, you know, it's the other thing that people, you know, young people use compression on everything. We didn't use any compression on a kick drum. It was all about getting the drummer to be consistent.
Mm-hmm.
And getting the right sound of the kick drum. And if he wasn't consistent, you'd cut the track over again. It's just the way it was.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And those drummers, though, they learned how to do it. They were consistent, you know, they're consistent timing wise, consistent hitting it. They knew what they were doing. So, but I do believe overall the sound, you know, at our studio, it was the sound of an API in the mix and on the guitars and on the vocals. At United, they were using a Neve console there, which sounded great too.
Yeah.
I mean, they had their techniques of getting the sound.
Yeah, it's hard to beat an API, that's for sure.
But, you know, there wasn't a lot of compression. Like, we had two LA-2As and two 1176s, and that was it, you know, for the whole studio. And we had two Echo plates, they were ENT plates, and we had one of the first digital delays, the DDL-1, and a loft flanger, and that was about it, you know. And then it was just making sounds, you know.
Yeah.
You know, just trying to figure out the best way to come up with new sounds.
Well, if you only had four compressors, what did you use them on generally?
Mostly just vocals.
Uh-huh.
I don't think I ever even compressed the bass, you know?
Yeah, wow.
I don't think we did. We just, it was mostly just vocals that we used those compressors on. I never, ever put a compressor on a drum until, I don't know, probably 2000. and I still don't. I really don't. Yeah. I still cut drums. Unless we're going for a special thing, you know, we're compressing a room or something for a special sound, you know.
Yeah.
But I just don't like choking off a snare while I'm recording because you can't get it back.
Yeah,
so
right.
I'm not one to do that. And if I did do it, I would put it on another track or something, you know.
Did you use the compression much while you're recording?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, as far as vocals, yeah. That was the thing. We always recorded all the vocals through an LA-2A, maybe backgrounds through 1176. And just a slight, Bob Dennis, the guy that taught me, he would smack our hand if it went over 3 dB of compression.
Hmm.
You know, he'd come up and go, "What are you doing?"
Yeah.
Okay. And so it was a consistent sound. And then, you know, then later on, I mean, when we were mixing, you'd control it by riding the vocal.
Yeah, sure.
You know?
Yeah.
We did have some automation, but even if we didn't have automation, we could edit mix a song.
Yeah.
You know, we'd work out the intro, print that, work out the first verse, print that, put them together and see if it all works, and then work our way through a song.
So you have some success then recording some great R&B, great funk. How did you get to Nashville from there?
Well, after I left that studio, I was working at another place, and we started getting some gospel clients in. There was this group called Commissioned, and the leader of that group was a guy named Fred Hammond, who still makes records today. He lives in Dallas. He's one of the top gospel artists. And their label was in Nashville. And I must have been around the fifth or sixth album. The record company would say, "Hey, why don't you guys come to Nashville and mix your records?" Well, my only concept of Nashville in 1985 was still Hee Haw from the 60s.
Yeah.
So we would laugh. We'd sit in the studio. What are we going to do in Nashville? We can't go to Nashville and mix. We'll lose all our funk. You know, even this isn't gospel music. We'd lose all our funk because that's how we talk. And boy, was I wrong about that. Anyways, what happened was eventually one of the A&R guys came to Detroit, and he was actually producing some other artists, and he was using this band's rhythm section for his other artist. And he was a really nice fella, and we cut all these tracks, and he said, "Hey, why don't you come and mix this in Nashville?" And I was like, okay, sure, why not? So I went there, and boy, that was a great experience. First day, we were in a studio, and Barry Beckett was in one room working with Leonard Skinner.
Wow.
We're doing this gospel record in another room, and Take Six is in another studio. And I just said, "You know, this is a great town.
Yeah.
There's a lot happening here."
Yeah.
I thought it was just country music. And my first experience was there were no country bands in the studio. And they had, you know, there were like five studios in this building, and there wasn't one country act recording at the time. And then I find out, you know, that Ziggy Marley is recording down the street and Foreigner's recording over at Emerald. And I'm like, this is truly Music City.
Yeah, I think people have the wrong idea about Nashville if you haven't been there. It's a great music town. It's very cosmopolitan, but people don't kind of get that until they go there for some reason.
I think for my generation it was ruined by Hee Haw. Seriously. I mean, I'm anybody my age, I'm 61. When I talked to them, the engineers that ended up here, they had the same problem. You know, they always thought of Nashville as being hick, and it's not at all.
Yeah.
You know, and the guys, man, I'll tell you, I learned so much from these guys recording country music. You know, it was a real experience coming here because, you know, in Detroit, we only had a few studios. And, you know, say, I said one studio, the studio I started out with had an API, and then there was a studio with a Neve. And then there was a couple studios that had MCI, JH500s. And came here, and it was like every room you went into, there was a different console. You know, there were SSLs, there were Neves, there were APIs, you know, there were old Neves, there were new Neves.
Yeah.
And you had to learn each console as you went in, because back in the 90s, you were at the mercy of the budget and the producer or the record company or the artist where they wanted to go. And so you'd walk in and you go, oh, I never worked on this before. Let's learn this console today. We got to mix a song by 6 o'clock.
Yeah.
So you learn to work your way through something just by listening to music in the room and then figuring out how the EQ worked and the compressors worked.
Well, okay. This is cool because you learn how to cut rock. You learn how to cut Motown style. You learn mm-hmm. how to do funk, and then you come to Nashville and now you're learning about country music and how to cut that. What's the approach? How's that different from the other three?
I think the biggest difference is that most of the time, and it's not always true today, but most of the time, all the guys are in the room at the same time and they're working out the arrangements. Like rock, they're in the room at the same time, but unlike rock, where usually like somebody like a Mitch Ryder band, they would know all the songs. You come in fresh. The guys playing don't know the songs at all. They've never heard them before. And they hear a quick little demo, acoustic guitar demo. Someone's writing a chart furiously. And then they all walk into a room and they work out an arrangement in like 10 or 15 minutes, or at least the first draft of an arrangement. And they play it perfectly the first time. And it's an amazing thing to see how they work all their parts together. And of course they can tear it down and break it up and, you know, pull things out and start, you know, say, well, let's just try this with the guitar or whatever. They'll do that. But most of the time there's this energy that happens in the first probably 2 to 3 takes that ends up being the record.
Wow.
In Nashville. One little quick aside. So the way I got into doing country, which I did a lot in the 90s, not so much in the last 10 years, 10 or 15, because everyone got fired at Warner Brothers, by the way, in the 90s.
Yeah.
I lost all my connections. But the way I got started was because of my R&B, I started doing all the dance remixes in country music in the middle 90s. Like for Tim McGraw and all these different artists. And from that, I started doing some country stuff and did John Michael Montgomery and Billy Ray Cyrus and those sorts of country guys.
It
came from the R&B side.
Got it. Was your miking technique any different?
No, that was the other thing I noticed. It was more of a rock. It was the rock miking technique, basically. And this was a real eye opener for me. And this is nothing against Detroit guitar players, but I could never get an acoustic guitar to sound the way I wanted to. I tried 5,000 different miking positions and, you know, stereo miking, mono miking, whatever, different mics. And I was never happy. And I'd hear once in a while in Detroit, every now and then we get in tapes from Muscle Shoals and from Nashville. And I hear this acoustic sound, and I'm like, what the heck? How do they get this sound? So I came here And the first tracking session I did, I just went, I'm going to mic this guitar. I'm going to, in a stereo miking with two KM84s, one at the bridge, one at the 12th fret. And the guy hit the first chord, and I went, oh my God, that's that sound.
Yeah.
There's that sound. And so I figured out it had nothing to do with the mics. I mean, it did. I mean, you have to have good mics. You know, you can vary it. But, and you have to have good mic pre's. That's all a given. But it's the player and his instrument, period.
Yeah.
In Nashville, if you get a bad acoustic guitar player who just came in from Toronto. No, I'm just kidding. From up north, and he doesn't know how to play the way they do down here, you won't get the sound. But all the session cats, when they play, they have their sound, and you just have to figure out the best way to capture. You may, it's a matter, you know, move the microphone a lot, the mics around a little bit, and sit in the room and listen to the guitar and see what it's doing. But generally, if you've been in that close area, they'll just play and it'll come out, and they can hear it in the phones too. They'll move themselves into position and they'll get the sound. So it isn't about the engineer, it's about the player. The engineers, they can get rid of all the engineers. I'm kidding.
Well, I noticed that with great players too, that, you know, they know it sounds good, and they'll move things, and it usually it's better when they do, because they just know what works, you know, with their gear.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's funny how, especially like electric guitar players, you know, if you're just using a 57 or something on the guitar and that's what they really want, and you can move it a half an inch off, you know, usually like obviously in the cone, you're off to the side, but they can tell like a half an inch one way or the other. And they'll go, oh, it's a little too bright. And you just move it a half an inch and, oh, that's it. They can tell right away in their phones. So I'll sit out there with a guitar player and move the mics around, and they'll have their phones on. I'll have my phones on, and we just move it till we like it.
I produced a
record. And it always it works great in the control room, too. Yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I produced a record a few years ago, and I'm one of those guys, I can't track and engineer and produce at the same time, so I always hire somebody. And in this case, I was doing a book with Ken Scott, and Ken, so I said, Ken, will you come in and track for me? And he did, and it was great, because I'm watching all these Abbey Road techniques, you know, that he's used, you know, on countless hits. But one of the cool things was he took a C12 and he put it on the bass amp. And he looked at me and he says, he put it on the bass amp.
Oh, wow.
A C12, and it was about a foot away. And he kind of looked at me sheepishly and he said, this is what I used to use on Paul, meaning McCartney, right? But then the stupid bass player on the session came in and said, why are you using that? Everybody uses a whatever, I think he said, a D112 or something. And I kicked him. Yeah. I kicked him and I said, you know, this is, do you realize who you're talking to here?
So. Yeah, it's Ken Scott.
Yeah.
By the way, he lives right down the street from me. I just found out.
Oh, really?
Well, like about a mile.
Yeah.
I'm doing a record in June for some Christian artist from England, and the record guy, a guy named Les Moyer, he's friends with Ken too, and he goes, John, Ken lives right down the street from you, I believe. He lives next to the Frothy Monkey. We need to go have coffee with him. And I said, well, sure, no problem. So I haven't met him yet. I'm going to meet him in June.
Oh, you'll enjoy him. He's
definitely
a fan. Great guy.
Definitely a fan.
Yeah. Speaking of Christian music, so that's where you spent the last, 10 or 15 years, right? Mostly doing that.
Yeah, just that's kind of the way it happened. As far as different sounds, I think it doesn't matter whether you're doing rock or Motown or R&B or country, everyone wants a good sound. So you just figure out the best method to get there. You know, I don't think there's really that much difference other than there's more of the pop Christian music, and then there's more of the R&B gospel, you know, African-American style gospel music, but they all want the same thing. They all want it to sound meaty on the bottom end and and have a nice top end and a good vocal. That's what it comes down to. You know, there aren't really that many different techniques that you use, although I guess the biggest difference might be that the contemporary Christian music might be more compressed sounding and the gospel stuff is more open.
So when you're mixing, does that mean you're using more bus compression or more compression on the individual instruments?
Probably a little bit of both, you know?
Yeah.
But I try to do it where you don't notice it that much, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I try to work. I mean, it's great. Speaking of, you know, mixing these days, I've ended up, of course, in the box like a lot of people. And it's pretty amazing what you can do these days with all these different plugs. I'm a real fan of Slate, you know,
yeah.
Virtual Channel. That really is pretty amazing.
I haven't tried it yet.
When you put it on every channel and then put it on the 2-mix out and you take it in and out, there's just this thing that happens, you know,
mm-hmm.
You go, whoa, it's not real, you know, a huge change, but it's just a subtle change. And you go, okay, yeah, that sounds like that's an SSL. And then this sounds like it's a Neve and this sounds like it's an API. It's pretty cool. And then of course he has his virtual tape machine too.
Right. Right.
Cause it's that little thing. All his plugs are really good as far as giving you some kind of analog warmth.
Besides that, what are your favorite plugs that you use?
I use FabFilter. I use their Pro Q2, which is just a great overall equalizer. You can shape anything with it.
Yeah.
And then FabFilter makes this other thing called Saturn, which is just a way to do like multi-band tape or distortion, amp distortion across the spectrum. So you, like, if you were going to take something that just wasn't like there's a B3 and the guy just didn't have the stops pulled out correctly and it just sounds really dull, but EQ doesn't really do anything for it. You can like either add some tape, distortion. I wouldn't call it that, but just a little, you know, over amping it through the tape or over amping it with some kind of the amplifier that they have built into the Saturn. And it's just, and you can move it across the spectrum, you know, and divide it up into four parts, you know, just whatever you want to. It's a great plug. It just does things to music that you would have to spend a lot of time reamping to do.
Mm.
That's one. So FabFilter's awesome. I like this. There's this Polish company. You can relate to this, PSP.
Oh yes. I know them well.
I use their Vintage Warmer 2 on the 2-mix for limiting. I just barely touch it. And they make a great version of the PCM 42 delay. And they have this one EQ called the PSP MQ.
Yes.
Which is kind of, I guess it kind of reminds me of that, the Neve AMEC EQ that Neve made a few years ago.
Yeah.
You know, back 10, 15 years ago. That's a great EQ for adding air and even upper mids if something needs some bite to it. I guess other things that I use I use UAD, a couple of things. I love their Pultec MQ1.
Yeah.
And it was great to get the Dimension D back, the one Dimension D, they make that.
Yeah.
Use that on bass. I missed that for a long time. And then I use this, you know, a lot of Waves plugins, the standard Waves plugins and the CLA series and the SSL series. I love that CLA LA2A.
Yeah.
Because whenever they sampled Chris's LA2A, it just had the right amount of distortion in it or something. The tubes were really old or something, because it seemed like when I used the UAD ones, they were too clean because they were like the spec. I know there's other ones too. There's other LA2As that UAD makes. I haven't tried all of them. So
I find the same thing with the LA3. which I love the LA 3, and I thought I loved it on the UAD, but I think I like the Waves one even better.
Yeah, I think it's just, you know, the way they did the sampling or the convolution of it. It just, his compressors, I don't know if the tape, the tubes rolled or what, I don't know, but they sound great.
Yeah. Are you a Pro Tools guy?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Because I know that there's a lot of guys in Nashville that are on Nuendo, which is a very cool platform as well, but it just seems the rest of the world is on Pro Tools. It's so much easier.
I think it's just mainly because everyone else is on it, and it works really well. You know, I'm used to it. You know, when I had to make the transition from consoles and analog, Pro Tools was the one that was around, and I got into it, you know, just as a tape machine starting around 2000, or maybe even earlier, or probably a little earlier as a tape machine, then gradually, you know, got into it more and more through the years. I think we went into the box probably 5 years ago.
Wow.
Well, we're actually just using it exclusively.
Do you miss anything about doing it old school on a console?
Sometimes I miss that interaction, really, of, you know, having all those faders in front of you, because I only have like 8 faders. Sometimes I miss that, but I've gotten so used to working with a mouse and the few faders that I have that I've gotten over it. But there was something about that when you were working a mix and you could just touch it, the whole thing, and you could just reach down, you know, to fader 36 and move up the reverb a half a dB really quick, and then come back and move something else, you know, right in front of you. There was something about that. But there's definitely way more control now than there ever was.
You know what I like about...
Than there ever was.
Yeah. You know what I like best about mixing in the box? It's the automation. And I never liked console automation. I never liked fader automation. It just seemed redundant to me. And this, it's so much easier to just, you know, go over and draw it in if you want, or, you know.
If you want to draw it in, it's there. It's amazing. I love it. And you can automate every single parameter of everything, you know, whether it's EQ or, you know, faders and EQ, and you can change reverb times right in the middle of the song. And, you know, it's amazing. It's really everything that when I was younger, we used to talk about.
Yeah.
Like, well, one day we'll be able to sit on the couch and EQ. Well, you can do that. I can do that with my iPad if I want to.
Yeah, right.
If I want to, it's all there. You can do it. And just the fact that you can, you know, do a mix and then say, this is good, but let's just go crazy and just think outside the box and change everything. And you know that it's there. And the other thing, one of the things that bugs me the most, I haven't, the last album I did solely on a console it was on the console and in conjunction with Pro Tools, was a Kirk Franklin album. And all I did all the time for 2 weeks, not 3 weeks, was fight the console, you know?
Yeah.
Trying to keep channels working, because there are very few studios that maintain their consoles like they were 25 years ago. And it's harder. It's just harder. So you're constantly checking Unity gain to make sure that each fader was working properly. And you'd be playing a mix, and all of a sudden the left side of the keys would go out and you're like, what happened? Yeah. It just dropped 4 dB. Never worrying about where center is. I always know where the center is.
Because
everything's working inside of Pro Tools. Everything works.
Yeah, and the fact you can recall it at any time and work on several mixes at the same time, you know, so many cool things about it.
Yeah, I do that all the time. And when you're working on a project and you come up with a new plan for the vocal, you can go, well, let's go see if we can apply it to mix number one now and see if it worked, you know, or to the bass or whatever. And then it either works or it doesn't. And you know, in 5 minutes or, you know, a minute, and you go, wow, I love it. Good. We'll go back to the other song now. That was great. We just made this song better. Now let's go back to this one again and apply something I just heard in that song to this song. you know.
Are your mixes shorter or longer now?
I think they're longer because you have the opportunity to spread it out over time, and unless there's a deadline. The other reason why they're longer is because people don't send you all the parts all at once, which is really frustrating.
Yeah.
But it does give you time to figure the songs out. But I hope no one hears this. No, I'm just kidding. I really hate it when they don't give you the lead vocal. It just drives me crazy to not know what the lead vocal is going to do.
Yeah.
Or I have to go listen to some rough mix that the lead vocal's in, and I still don't have the final lead vocal. And that's frustrating because you got to work the song around the vocal. You know, whether you start out with the drums or not, you still need to know what where the space is for the vocal and what the vocalist is doing.
When you get an album into mix, do you refer back to the rough, or do you just do it from instinct first?
Well, I always listen to the rough. Yeah, I think I do. If there's a rough, I listen to it because I want to know the last thing the producer was thinking about or what was most important to him, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it could be something that if you just started from scratch, you might miss the essence of the song if you don't hear the rough. Because if it's all about the piano and you gravitate towards the guitars in the song, you're going to be in trouble with the producer. Unless you've created this whole new experience and they're going to be blown away, but they usually aren't. Because they created the song around this one part, or they created the song around some loop, you know, and you don't realize it's all about the loop in that song. And the drums are not as important.
Yeah, yeah.
So I like to hear the rough. And then what happens is then I eventually throw away the rough, and once I get to that point where I know I've got the elements that were in the rough, then I'll pass the rough and just, you know, make it better and I'll forget about it. As long as I know I have all the elements that were in the rough in position.
Last question for you. What's the best piece of business advice that you've either received from someone along the way or you've learned?
Business advice?
Yeah. About the music business.
I probably just, you know, being personable and not being a dick.
Yeah.
You know, you learn to be a fun person in the studio, and if you're good enough, you'll get the clients, and the clients will come back if you're personable to them, and also just be nice to everyone, whether they're an intern or they're the president of the label, because, you know, as you know, the intern will become the president of the label one day.
Yeah.
So it'll hurt you later. And I've seen that happen to people in this business where they offended people early on in their career, and then they don't work because the person they offended ends up being in a position to hurt their business. So that's a business decision to be nice to people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or you should generally be nice to people anyways, but that's, you know, what I've learned in business as far as surviving in this business.
Couldn't agree more with
you. For a long time.
This has been great. Yash, the dynamite. I enjoyed meeting you, and I enjoyed speaking with you, and in getting the benefit of your experiences, which, you know, are varied, very varied compared to most people in the business.
Thanks, man. It was a pleasure talking to you too.
To find out more about John Yash, go to theyashman.com. That's THEJOSHMAN, all one word, theyashman.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@BobbyOInnerCircle. I want to thank Steve Cherubino, who's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at EDMMR. He helps put this show together. Thank you kindly, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, you can go to BobbyOsinski.com and select the podcast tab, or just go to BobbyOInnerCircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At BobbyOsinski.com and BobbyOInnerCircle.com,
You'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski, and I will see you next time.